It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Office of Veterans Affairs has experienced heavy turnover at the top, following blowback from an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease several years ago that infected more than 20 veterans and killed six. In late May, a former Navy Lieutenant Commander and Chief Operating Officer at Mercy Health in Youngstown, Ohio, agreed to be the new director of the Pittsburgh VA office. Donald Koenig spoke to The Confluence's Megan Harris about his plans to modernize and move the VA forward.
You stepped down from Mercy Health, I understand, in April of last year and assumed this role just a couple of months ago. What about this gig made you want to come out of retirement?
My first career really was 13 years active duty as a Navy JAG officer and active duty lawyer, and then spent 20 years with Mercy Health System in Ohio, first as their system compliance officer and assistant general counsel, did that for 11 years. And then I decided I'd like to run a hospital. Had never done that before. And the one that I picked that they said, yeah, let's give you a try there, is St. Elizabeth Youngstown Hospital, the largest, most complex hospital in that entire health system. And it was a great 9 years doing that also.
Is that a common career pivot?
Not at all. Not at all. To go from lawyer to running a hospital? No, but I found it terrifically challenging, interesting, never a boring day.
Was a background in compliance very helpful for that?
Yes. It provides you a great background because there's so many different federal regulations to have that compliance background when you're trying to either put together a deal to acquire a physician practice, knowing those boundaries of what kinds of things you can do and can't do. So compliance was a great background and preparation.
So the Pittsburgh office of the VA has seen its share of challenges in the last couple of years. High leadership turnover, Legionella outbreaks, even deaths. Did any of that scare you, that challenge coming in?
Certainly not. While that was reported that I was the sixth leader in 5 years, well, that's counting people who are in
temporary
interim roles,
and
temporary
permanent
roles.
Yes.
I'm the third permanent leader in about 9 or 10 years. So it's a little more
settled.
That's
a much nicer number.
Absolutely. So no, nothing about that frightened me in any way. So I have this opportunity to think about, do I want to retire or is there something else I'd like to do? I read more and more about how the VA was trying to recruit experienced civilian healthcare leaders because of things like the Mission Act and recognizing that for the first time, the VA will have to compete for the loyalty of our veterans because they'll have other options. So we thought about it and I said, you know, maybe I would like to see what the VA has to offer. The very first day I go on to their website to see what job openings. Here it is in Pittsburgh, my hometown. I grew up in Bethel Park. My wife's from Oakmont. It was like, okay, I think that's the sign I needed that this is where I'm meant to be. So I started that process and going through the interviews and everything, just a wonderful experience of learning all the great things they've been doing here. You know, Legionella, that was an incredible tragedy for the hospital. It is something that many hospitals, many cities, many apartment buildings, anytime you have an older building and you start doing construction, there's a possibility. I'm so proud to report that the Pittsburgh VA folks are now the VA's Legionella experts in the entire organization, provide guidance and support to any other VA facility that's having issues. And it's amazing that Legionella is not just limited to old buildings. You may have seen the story a couple months ago. A brand new hospital opened right outside of Columbus, Ohio, $350 million. And they disclosed about a month and a half after opening that we have a Legionella problem.
Highly contagious.
And indeed, one of the patients was admitted the very first day it had opened. So when they were getting ready to open, there's supposed to be a final flushing of water systems where if water has been standing for a while, it can form. So, and the amazing thing is no state or federal requirement for that kind of flushing. So it's something organizations learn on their own. And so the VA has a very robust program. So we're constantly monitoring. And because it's so important to restore that trust with our veterans, you go to our homepage on the web and go down the right side, Legionella. And we show you every month all of our test results of all of our water, because we want everyone to know that, you bet, we've got the finger on the pulse at all times, and we're being very transparent about sharing that.
Does the organization or the staff carry a chip on its shoulder at all? Now it's in front of the industry on it, but it was at a cost of human life.
Oh, definitely. Those who were there and lived through it, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It certainly is life-changing. You know, anyone who goes into healthcare goes into to help, to heal, to serve, and to, oh my gosh, something that we did here, you know, might have injured or even killed a patient. Absolutely. It affects everyone deeply. But I think the organization did a phenomenal job of saying, okay, we absolutely are going to learn from this. We will not let this happen again. And here are the steps that we're doing so that people can feel both confident and comfortable that they're getting the world-class care they deserve and expect.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking to VA Director Donald Koenig. I'm curious, you've been in charge for about 2 months now. Is it what you expected?
Yes. There are some things that are very similar to my civilian hospital experience at Youngstown. You never know what the day is going to bring. There's always something new going on. It might seem like a crisis for at least the first 30 minutes, and then you start digging. Okay, so it's never a boring day. But anytime I get the least bit frustrated with I'm not making the progress I want to on something, I just go down to the lobby and sit down and talk to a veteran. The stories are incredible, and it immediately just recenters you. Yeah, this is why I'm here. These are the people I'm here to help take care of. But no, nothing has really surprised me. A phenomenal team. You know, we're 3,400 staff members across 7 campuses. So we've got folks that are changing that care model. Instead of the veterans all having to come to Pittsburgh, we're figuring out how do we take more and more care to places like St. Clairsville and Uniontown and Greensburg to make it closer and easier for veterans to get care.
You mentioned that changing care. How are initiatives like the Government's Mission Act changing so much about how we think about urgent care services, for example?
Absolutely. So the Mission Act started on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, and that was after a year of preparation of getting ready for it. So it was Congress and the administration's direction and legislation that said, we want to make sure no veteran ever waits too long to get care, and we want to give them that option to go outside.
And so, there were reports that Pittsburgh, some veterans were waiting more than a year not too long ago.
I'm not sure how recent that was. We're doing great right now. The wait times are very, very short. That's been the amazing thing nationwide. So we started the Mission Act across the entire VA. And this year, the entire VA has seen 1 million more patient visits than they did the prior year, despite the fact that veterans can now also go out into the community. And we are seeing an increased number of patients who qualify to go under the Mission Act, and we're providing them those consults so they can go out.
What are those qualifications?
So it's a fascinating set of, for primary care or mental health, it's we must be able to give you an appointment within 20 days, and the driving time from where you live has to be less than 30 minutes for primary care.
For any of those branch offices?
Yes. Yes. So we measure that from where they live to the closest VA site that offers it. For specialty care, it's 28 days for the appointment and 60-minute driving time. So again, we are able to offer the veterans the option if they want to. It's amazing. A large number of veterans, when presented the option, say, no, I'm going to stay with the home team. I want to stay with the VA. And we try to work with them. For those who are curious about it, a lot of them, their first question is, so if I want to go to UPMC, how long will it take me to see a gastroenterologist there?
Yeah.
Versus, you know, and so we try to help them know those times so that they can make informed choices.
Are there any hard and fast rules about how quickly someone can get into, say, specialty care? Like, I know that AHN will take this long, or I have an idea that UPMC might take that long.
The amazing thing that we're offering much more of is particularly through telehealth video conference connections.
Directly with VA healthcare professionals?
Directly with VA healthcare professionals. We can often see the patient the very next day. And we have a number of programs that for veterans who live in rural areas or it's hard to travel, we'll even provide them the iPad essentially so that they can talk to their physician from the comfort of their own home. So we're doing a lot more of that. I think the main statistic I remember is for this past full year, VA Pittsburgh did more than 35,000 video teleconference connections with veterans to provide care.
Well, and another thing that I've seen so much reporting on lately is urgent care being added to the VA's offerings. That's for those times when you'd like to see someone quickly, but it's not so dire that you need to go to the emergency room.
Exactly.
Honestly, as a civilian, it never occurred to me that that hadn't been an option for our veterans. Why do you think it took so long to get that integrated into the VA system?
Well, the Mission Act replaced about three or four other piecemeal acts that came together. So part of this was bringing everything together and saying, okay, what do our veterans really need? And kind of phasing it in pieces. So the urgent care, the ability to go outside was kind of phase one that's gone live. And it took a little time. I think on the day it went live, June 6th, across the whole nation, there were maybe 4,000 urgent cares registered. I think as of today, it's like 9,000. So there's a number growing each week, which is why we advertise on the website and think, here's the website to see all of the urgent cares in this area. And then depending on the veteran's status, they have a priority status. Some of them will be able to see urgent care for free. Some of them may have a $30 copay depending on their care status. But we're trying to make it convenient for our veterans to get care when and where they want it.
So traditionally, VA patients have always had to go to the VA. Now they can see other doctors. What do you make so far of this privatization and more openness, being able to see the healthcare provider that maybe the patient is more comfortable with?
Sure. We don't see the Mission Act as moving at all towards privatization. This is all putting the power in the hands of the veterans to make the choice as to what's best for them. Every day, large Greyhound-style buses pull into the VA, coming from Altoona, coming from Erie, coming from Butler, full of patients coming for their appointments. So we eventually, I would love to turn it upside down, and instead of inviting the big Greyhound-style buses in, I want to send out a Wi-Fi-enabled small van with two or three doctors and nurses to go to see the veterans closer to where they are. That's part of our response to the Mission Act, saying if we want to be their easiest choice, we've got to make it easiest for them to see us too. So we are certainly trying to take more of the specialty care closer to where the veterans live.
Well, as you're looking ahead and thinking about what's possible, whether it's telemedicine or other offerings, ways to see your patients, what else is out there? What else is on your to-do list, short or long term?
We certainly want to continue modernizing in the middle term the UD campus in Oakland. Our main patient tower dates from the 50s, and we are slowly modernizing that. We've had a couple additions with newer beds. That process will certainly continue. Certainly, as the age of the veterans we are caring for continues to age, the campus we have out in Aspinwall with, we call it a community living center, skilled nursing. So we have folks who, that becomes their residence for them. And so we're caring for them and want to make sure we have enough room for patients out there. The neat thing is we're getting close to striking distance of being one of those six or seven cities in the U.S. that will be able to say we've virtually eliminated homeless veterans. Those are all big goals for us. In terms of, boy, if you really start thinking, one of the huge gems that we have is the Human Engineering Research Lab, a joint venture with the University of Pittsburgh. These are the most amazing engineering marvels who are focused on mobility for people who have challenges, either the catastrophic injuries or a disease process that has robbed them of their ability to move about freely.
One thing I haven't heard much about yet is mental health. Is there anything that the VA feels that it's acutely capable of providing?
Yes, absolutely. Mental health and behavioral health is one of the pillar focus areas for the VA. When we built the new wing out in Oakland so that we could close the Highland Park campus, it is a beautiful state-of-the-art four-story behavioral health tower. And so we have outpatient, we have inpatient, we're addressing PTSD, the huge VA program of getting every employee to think about being there to try to help early identify people who may be at risk for suicide and how do we most effectively intervene. That's the big scourge we're all focused on.
So as you look ahead, how do you think you're going to be able to bring some more of those veterans back into the fold and maybe inspire loyalty in those that are now considering seeking services elsewhere?
Sure. The main points of customer loyalty and that our veterans tell us, one, they trust the VA. Two, the respect they're shown by everyone there. We are all so honored to take care of them. They really feel like they've come home. And they regularly tell us when they go to civilian facilities, it's just not quite the same. So we're really working on the experience, the high quality outcomes that we are demonstrating. There was just a Dartmouth Health Atlas study early last year that compared VA health safety outcomes to both UPMC and Allegheny General. And they said VA hospitals frequently nationwide, including here in Pittsburgh, perform as well or better than their main civilian competitors. I said, okay, when are we unrolling that giant banner on the front of the hospital that says, welcome to one of the best quality hospitals in Pittsburgh?
So what about you? Have you bought a place yet, or are we still in that hotel honeymoon period?
No, I'm still commuting in from Youngstown. It's 75 miles each way, but in the summertime, it's about 75 minutes. Sherry and I have lived in Youngstown for 10 years. We love the neighbors. We love the house. We have no kids at home. She loves her hairdresser. So we talk about how much disruption we want to bring by moving back to Pittsburgh. But fortunately, the VA gives me a year to decide. So I said, let me wait until after this winter. And if Youngstown has 110 inches of snow, we'll see how that commute is. And so we may decide to eventually come back. But for right now, the commute is working just fine. But it's wonderful to be back in Pittsburgh. It's been a long time since I've lived here.
And commuter, no plans to stick around?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is where I'm meant to be. This is the work I'm meant to be doing with a great team. And so you bet I'm not going anywhere.
Donald Koenig is the new permanent director of the Pittsburgh VA. Thank you so much for joining us on The Confluence.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a group of merchants in McKeesport priced their poultry at 5 cents under the federal ceiling to, quote, smash the black market that had been thriving in that area in 1945. A Post-Gazette article says the decision came as a result of multiple violations in the McKeesport Office of Price Administration District by illegal sellers. Merchants hoped the lower prices would ward off the unregistered dealers, who were known for selling chickens directly out of their trucks for $3 to $5. The regulations were taken seriously at the time because the U.S. was at war and communities were operating with food ration books. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania has a type of wetland that's home to rare species. Peatlands are made up of partially decomposed plant and sometimes animal material. This ecosystem is vulnerable to development and climate change. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Kara Holsoppel visited one in the southwestern part of the state.
When I meet up with a group of scientists in the parking lot of Laurel Summit State Park, there are clues about what we're in for.
I always go with a hiking pole, which is especially good for wetlands for testing out how deep the water is or how far you might sink in.
David Yaney is an ornithologist with the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy. His colleague, Marianne Ferretti, is suiting up.
Everyone else is going with knee boots. I didn't bring mine, so I'm going to go with chest waders.
Ferretti is an ecologist with the Conservancy and the monitoring and assessment manager for this effort to study 30 peatland sites in Pennsylvania, which are mostly located in the northeast and northwestern part of the state. But it's just a short walk along a gravel trail to see one here. Ephraim Zimmerman is a plant community ecologist and, like his colleagues, part of the Pennsylvania Natural Heritage Program, which looks at rare species and habitat in the state.
So this is a red oak mixed hardwoods forest. That's up at the top of this ridge.
We're about 2,700 feet above sea level, pretty high for this part of the state. Along the trail, we see rhododendron, pink mountain laurel, and a lot of thigh-high ferns in the shade. And then
there's some blueberry bushes.
The hardwoods are behind us, and a small boardwalk looks out onto the sunny wetland. Clusters of carnivorous pitcher plants are blooming with tall purple flowers. They look like upside-down umbrellas.
So Spruce Flats Bog is the name of this locality, but it has no spruce here.
Apparently, Zimmerman says, the frontier people and workers who logged this area called any conifer tree a spruce. But what's left in this wetland are some pine and hemlock the loggers didn't get. Tall, windswept ones line the perimeter, and the old stumps dot the interior like islands.
They might only be a foot high, but in that small elevation change, you have moisture differences. And so you could have 4, 5, 6 different species of moss growing there.
Sphagnum moss is by far the most common here.
It almost looks like a green shag rug from the 70s.
Spruce Flats Bog is also home for many common animal species like deer and bear. But a butterfly called the bog copper relies on the wild cranberry of peatland habitat. And of course, there are birds.
There was a Canada warbler singing over here, and Canada warbler is one of our top focal species.
These are birds they're paying special attention to because the need for conservation is so high. In Canada, they're listed as threatened.
What kind of sound does it make?
So it's kind of chip, chip-choppity, cheep-chirpity. It's kind of a fast, sputtery song. Birds are really linked to habitat type, and that's one reason that we're looking at birds, because they're a good indicator of change. They're a good way to monitor what's going on within a system.
These birds, Yaney says, have a boreal affinity. Boreal meaning north. Ephraim Zimmerman says that's what makes these places in Pennsylvania so unusual.
In Maine and Wisconsin and in Canada, where you have these vast expanses of these boreal ecosystems, we have something that's kind of a remnant, a southern extreme of this type.
We head off the trail, and the ground starts to become less solid within a couple of minutes. Soon, it's like walking on a waterbed across stretches of moss, and it smells a little like a wet basement.
It's always good to stick to the higher points if you don't want to sink in too far.
Like, yeah, I'm ankle deep now. Oh. Uh-oh. Okay, there we go.
Pro tip, to avoid getting stuck, aim for moss that's lighter in color. It's drier and more likely to be solid underneath.
All right, you made it.
I made it.
You made it to plot number one.
Here, Zimmerman takes a soil core sample to get a better picture of what's happening in the muck beneath our feet.
So I'm cutting through the roots and the living material of the sphagnum.
He slices at it with a small knife and removes it. Then he grabs onto a longer tool that looks like a pogo stick with a sharp end.
This is the soil auger, and this is what you can do to get the deeper material. I can't reach my hand down that much farther. I get progressively more decomposed material as I go lower.
Peatland is acidic. There's little oxygen, so the plants here decompose slowly, and the soil core samples tell a story.
Some of our peatlands, we've seen that there would be a layer of undecomposed peat, and then there would be a layer of very decomposed plant material, and then another undecomposed layer. So some kind of shift happened. Many hundreds of years data is found within these peatlands.
Climate change could alter the ecosystem here. Climate models predict more wet weather for Pennsylvania. Zimmerman says that could mean the entire water table rises, pushing the wetland out into the surrounding trees. Marianne Ferretti says the trees in this wetland act like straws, sucking up water, then it evaporates into the atmosphere. Higher temperatures from global warming could increase evaporation, creating different patterns of drying here.
The purpose of the work that we're doing is beginning to document what's here, and without that good solid baseline data, we don't have a comparison for just future scenarios.
David Yaney says when they come back in 5 to 7 years to do the next round of sampling, they'll see how conditions have changed.
A really important thing is to be able to provide this information to land managers and conservation groups.
Ephraim Zimmerman says one thing they know for sure is that change is constant. This wetland will someday become a shrub swamp and then revert back into the hemlock forest, if the hemlock woolly adelgid pest doesn't kill them first.
The more that you protect large areas like this and connected landscapes, you can protect the high-quality small areas within that larger matrix.
That way, the plants and animal species in this special little pocket of habitat have a chance to adapt and survive, whatever the future brings. Kara Holsoppel, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. House, by more than a 3-to-1 margin, has approved and sent to the U.S. Senate a bill that would amend the Horse Protection Act and end the painful practice of soaring. Joining us on the line is Marty Irby. He's executive director at Animal Wellness Action and past president of the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association. Marty, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for having me. I really appreciate it.
For those of us who are unaware, what is soaring?
So soaring is the intentional infliction of pain to Tennessee walking, racking, and spotted saddle horses' front feet by means of utilizing mustard oil, croton oil, or kerosene, caustic chemicals that are applied to the skin, and or inserting sharp objects under the horse's hooves so that they feel pain and incidentally lift their legs much higher than they normally would in their natural gait. It would be like if you were running across hot asphalt or hot coals barefooted. You'd want to move really fast and throw your legs up high to not put them on the ground. In this type of practice, the horses that are out there showing are rewarded based on who lifts their legs the highest.
So it is done right before the presentation, right before they are on, if you would?
Well, it's done throughout their lives. Many of them live in pain and agony every day at the barn where they're stabled. And then a lot of the trainers do, of course, come back to the horses again and soar them even more for the horse show so that they're at their prime, as you would say.
How long has the practice been going on overall, and where is it most widespread?
So it started in the late 1950s in Tennessee, and one horse, his name was Talk of the Town, had a trainer named Steve Hill who had applied some chemicals to the horse's feet for the purposes of healing and accidentally soared him and discovered that he could lift his legs much higher, and then none of the other horses could defeat him. So they just continued to do this to horses, and it continued to grow across the Southeast and really across the country. Currently, it's really rampant in Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, and Georgia. But for years, there were pockets of soaring going on in states like Pennsylvania. There were trainers heavily involved in soaring in Pennsylvania for years, and Pennsylvanians just said, we're not going to tolerate this anymore, and they drove those type of people out of the state by eliminating those type of horse shows.
So we do still have plenty of horse shows all over Pennsylvania, from 4-H horse shows to a national horse show scheduled in October in Harrisburg. So from your knowledge, this is not done in Pennsylvania anymore?
That's correct, yes. And we've had a tremendous base of advocacy in Pennsylvania. It's one of the top states in the country on this issue. And you actually have had the entire Pennsylvania House delegation vote in support of the bill, and both Senators Pat Toomey and Bob Casey are original sponsors of the Senate companion bill as well.
So the vote was 333-96 in the House to end this practice. What has been the argument for continuing it?
Well, most of the people who oppose the PAST Act would say one of two or three things. They would say that either soaring is a thing of the past and doesn't exist, which is not true because the USDA's own inspection results and tests have proven otherwise. The second argument would be that the government shouldn't be involved in regulating this type of industry and that they should be able to self-police, which they've had the opportunity to do for more than 60 years now and haven't solved the problem. So the government stepping in to protect the horses is really almost a last resort because the industry itself has not done it. And then, you know, I guess the third argument they would say that they would have against the PAST Act is that there is some cost to the horse shows that are put on for the inspections of the PAST Act. We believe that it's very minimal. I don't think it would impact many horse shows by just, you know, a few hundred dollars at the most, and would require that a licensed inspector, generally a veterinarian, be there to inspect the horses.
PAST, that's prevent all soaring tactics, correct?
Correct.
I thought that I heard that soaring laws are already on the books. Is that the case? And if so, why is this measure needed then?
So there are soaring laws in the books. The Horse Protection Act was passed in 1970 by former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings, who was a Democrat from Maryland, and he was a good friend of mine. He passed away last fall, and it outlawed soaring, but the act left loopholes that allowed soaring to persist and was actually amended in 1976 to allow self-policing. USDA has not fully enforced it, and they left primarily one particular area that has been of heavy controversy, and they allow these large stacked shoes that sometimes are 6 or 8 inches tall to be attached to horses' feet. They're like giant platforms, and ankle chains that you would see that just look grotesque, like any chain you would find in a hardware store that they place around the horse's feet, and they're allowed to show with these devices in the show ring. And so this legislation would eliminate the use of those devices in the show ring, and it would also license USDA inspectors as subcontractors at no cost to the federal government to be sent out to horse shows to inspect the horses instead of allowing them to self-police like they've done. And then it would also increase the penalties that are in the current Horse Protection Act.
Pennsylvania's U.S. Senators, as you mentioned, Bob Casey and Pat Toomey are co-sponsors of the Senate version of the legislation. Do you anticipate passage by the Senate?
We do have an uphill battle in the Senate. Unfortunately, the two senators from Tennessee, Lamar Alexander and Marsha Blackburn, are very much opposed to this legislation. But we have 43 co-sponsors in the Senate of 100 members, and we've had as many as 60 in the past. So I do believe that we can move this legislation through the Senate. We have about 16 months left in the Congress to do so. And as long as public pressure continues to mount a challenge to the opposition, then I do believe that we can move this through the upper chamber in Congress.
Without the soaring, without the exaggerated gait known as the big lick, as you explain, are the horses any less impressive?
Well, they have a beautiful, wonderful, natural gait, and to me, they're very impressive in their natural state. They do have some animation and lift their legs to a certain height naturally and just perform a beautiful gait with their head shake. And, you know, I believe that if soaring could end, that the Tennessee Walking Horse would grow and thrive like never before, and people would want to go back to horse shows and see these horses because they would know that they weren't being abused. So I think that they have a great, tremendous appeal and have much more versatile competition divisions available that they could compete in than other breeds.
Marty Irby is Executive Director of Animal Wellness Action and past president of the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association. Marty, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate you all covering this issue, and thank the people of Pennsylvania for supporting our cause and standing up to protect the horses.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last summer, Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord broke a story about city real estate manager Aaron Pickett selling himself a city-owned house. Nearly a year later, there's a new development in that saga. Rich is on the line from the Post-Gazette newsroom. Welcome back to the show, Rich.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Rich, remind us what Aaron Pickett did.
Sure. Mr. Pickett was hired by the city of Pittsburgh in 2014 to run its real estate division. And one of the jobs of the real estate division is to try to sell to interested buyers tax delinquent and city-owned properties. In 2016, he applied to be a buyer of city-owned property with the department he ran. And he, not too surprisingly, was approved as a buyer. And then in 2017, he finished the purchase from the city of a house in Beachview for $2,500. City Council approved that purchase, and Mr. Pickett signed the documents as both the buyer and the seller of that property. That resulted in our stories.
Right.
And I'm sorry.
I was going to say, were there any other prospective buyers for that house?
Yeah, we requested roughly 1,500 applications, and we found three buyers who had specifically sought to purchase the same property that Mr. Pickett ended up buying. And normally, the procedures for the sale of a property in which multiple buyers are interested, that would kick it to an auction, which would be supervised by a judge. But no auction occurred in this case, and the property passed to Mr. Pickett without any kind of competitive bidding, and those folks didn't get a chance.
Did he violate any city rules at the time?
The city is saying that they had and currently still don't have any rule that bars the employees who sell city property from also being buyers of city property. We're told by the city finance director, Margaret Lanier, that her department and the law department have been in months of back and forth on the language of a restriction that would prevent this from happening in the future. But it could still happen today.
So he spent paid $2,500 from your investigation. Did you get a sense of what others might have been willing to pay for the house?
One of the applicants said that he was fully prepared to pay $40,000 for that house. That house is assessed by the county at a little over $100,000, but that could well be a little bit above what it's really worth on the market. But we did have a buyer who said $40,000 would have been entirely within his price range. Mm-hmm.
So why did the State Ethics Commission get involved in this?
We don't know specifically whether they were triggered by the reporting or whether the city Office of Municipal Investigations or the Mayor's Administration asked the State Ethics Commission to look at this, but they did, and this week they came up with their conclusion.
And what was that conclusion?
They found that Mr. Pickett did violate the State Ethics Act by being both the essentially the seller and the buyer of a public asset. They said that he assessed and set the sale price of real property owned by the city while he was planning to purchase it, and then he also executed a proposal to purchase the agreement between the city and himself, and they ordered him to make some recompense.
Did they clarify that, or is that just under wraps what that recompense is?
Nope. They told him he's got to pay $5,000 to the state, and that if he sells the property within 5 years and if he makes some profit on it, he has to give the state the profits minus the $5,000, which he's paying initially.
Your initial reporting, I believe, back in last August, talked about the city renewing an investigation. Did that go anywhere, or did that investigation lead to the State Ethics Commission get involved? Were you able to connect the dots?
As far as we know, the city's Office of Municipal Investigations did take a look at this, but if they recommended any action, they have not been public about it. We asked Mayor Peduto yesterday what he thought of this situation, and he told us that he has not had a chance to digest this fully at this point, but that he will likely speak to it in the coming days, so we're waiting to hear from him.
Does he face any further discipline consequences from the city? Because, as you said, there was no rule then, and there still, at this point, is no rule prohibiting it.
His direct supervisor, the city finance director and treasurer, Margaret Lanier, is not planning any further city action at this point regarding Mr. Pickett. She indicates that he's been a good leader of that department, respected, effective, hardworking. So his direct supervisor has no further plans. We don't yet know whether the administration or the mayor will take the same line.
Or they could propose something legislatively, or what? Is that a possibility?
We don't think that city council would likely get involved directly in a personnel matter involving an individual, but we do expect that the city is going to introduce a proposal to council to keep this from happening in the future. City employees as a whole would still be able to buy city-owned property, but the folks who administer the sale of city-owned property would be barred. At least that's what Treasurer Lanier is talking about so far.
All right. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord, thanks so much for joining us today.
Been a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, human trafficking. It's the fastest growing organized crime activity in the country, with many of the victims being children. We'll talk about a new program by the Pittsburgh FBI office to recover child victims. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.